This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find that on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes. Sarah Palin, champion of democracy, with a challenge for journalists everywhere.
Democracy depends on you. And that is why, that's why our troops are willing to die for you. So, how about, in honor of the American soldier, you quit making things up.
Sarah Palin wants a fiction moratorium for the media as she walks away from being Alaska's governor. Her new full-time gig, GOP media event. Palin meets her maker, the media. If it's stranger than fiction, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Monday, June 27th. I'm John Hockenberry. All your Palin news later on this hour. On The Takeaway this hour, Ben Bernanke is doing what Fed chiefs almost never do. He's talking to the press, even answering questions from the public. We'll look at his unusual strategy and whether he'll keep his job. Plus, reality TV as a teachable moment for young people. Sounds like a joke, but there are lessons for families here, and we're going to explain. Right now, if it's Monday, it's Meet the Marcus Mabry, international business editor for our partner, The New York Times. He's the executive chef for our weekly news diet. Marcus, looking forward, is this the last moment in the sun for Sarah Palin now that she's walked away from the governorship of Alaska?
Well, John, you know, in many ways, one could argue, and she kind of summed it up, I think, with her farewell speech, Sarah Palin is the ultimate candidate of reality TV show America. It could only be in America, and it would make a phenomenal reality show. I think what you have to say about her is both for her fans, for the delight of her fans, and probably for the delight of her detractors as well, Sarah Palin ain't going nowhere.
All right, Marcus, we'll continue that conversation in just a moment. First, everything you need to know this morning in the headlines, the healthcare issue hot in D.C. House Democrats meet today for extensive talks on the legislation. Still major differences within the Democrats on how to overhaul healthcare. Also in Washington, high-level talks between the U.S. and China start today. President Obama will be there, as will top cabinet members, security, trade, and the environment, all on the table. Other Obama administration heavies are working their way outside the Beltway today. Defense Secretary Robert Gates is meeting with Israeli leaders. He's actually gone off to Jordan at this hour, but Special Envoy George Mitchell is now in Egypt. Gates says Iran should respond to U.S. diplomatic overtures by September. Also today, Israel refuses to rule out a unilateral military strike on Iran. North Korea appears to be open to new nuke talks. It's out with a new cryptic statement that seems to suggest direct talks with the United States are an option. To sports, where Alberto Contador is the Tour de France winner. Lance Armstrong took third place. Contador has won two of the last three tours. Also in Paris, French President Nicolas Sarkozy is now out of the hospital and okay. You may have heard that doctors say heat and overwork caused his Sunday sudden jogging collapse. Space Shuttle Endeavour astronauts are taking one last spacewalk. They undock from the International Space Station tomorrow. Asian markets are up, gazing more than 1% across the region. Today, the Dow starts trading at 90.93. The S&P begins at 9.79. And the NASDAQ kicks off at 1965. Futures trading suggests a positive but flat opening. Last night, Ben Bernanke faced a town meeting. Yes, it's unprecedented. We're going to talk about it. We're always interested in your stories about the economy at 877-8-MY-TAKE. But today, if you've been furloughed, it means you can't burn any bridges. You kind of have a job, but you're not getting paid. What are you doing? How are you making ends meet? Tell us your furlough stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Our government.
Healthcare.
Your government.
The economy.
Bail-in.
Global financial recession.
Transportation.
Agenda.
Agenda.
The work that needs to be done.
What's going on? What's going on? What's going on? What's going on? Yeah, what's going on?
And we ask, as we do every Monday morning, what is the agenda for this, a midsummer July week? around the world. And the question that I have for Marcus Mabry, international business editor for The New York Times, and Rob Watson, BBC defense and security correspondent for our partners, the BBC, who joins us from London. Good morning to you both, by the way.
Good morning.
And Marcus, you'd have a hard time knowing which was the most important ally to the United States this week, Israel or China. Huge meetings going on between both. Let's begin with China.
Well, you know, there is, not to plug a competitor, but, you know, you got to do what you got to do. There's a great editorial in the Wall Street Journal by Hillary Clinton and Tim Geithner. And in it, they point out that 30 years ago, when the U.S. and China first established diplomatic relations, our economy was basically 14 times the size of the Chinese economy. 30 years later, today, our economy is 3 times the size of the Chinese economy. It's getting closer and closer, and that economic reality says it all.
Well, let's listen to Timothy Geithner during his confirmation hearings in late January, and he stumbles at a particular point on an issue that I think is very, very touchy. And listen to this, and let's talk for a moment.
I do believe that it is a significant issue. As I said earlier, I believe it's important for the United States and for the global economy that our major trading partners operate with a flexible exchange rate system.
Flexible exchange rate system. Flexible exchange rate system is like the central issue between the U.S. and China right now. Explain.
It is. Well, what it means is the Chinese do not allow their currency, as the Europeans do with the euro, as all the major economies in the world do, except for theirs. They do not allow their currency to float, the markets to decide what their currency should be in relation to other currencies. So what that means is the Chinese producers or exporters have an advantage that no one else's exporters do, because the government is making sure that their goods are cheap for you and me, and that our goods, the American goods that try to get in China, are expensive for the Chinese. So it is a major problem. It's interesting because Secretary Geithner has since he's actually got the nod and became the actual guy who could do something about this, or at least ask the Chinese to do something about this, he has reversed himself, and he no longer makes that important policy.
So not likely that this will come up, but North Korea probably will come up. Correct?
It will definitely come up. You know, Secretary Clinton, she's made a great deal of talking about how everything's changed for North Korea, and she tried to say the whole strategic context for North Korea and international relations have changed, and they no longer have anyone on their side defending them for and helping them become a state, remain a rogue state. It's going to be interesting to see this week if that's actually true or not. Will the Chinese actually come out with the Americans and say North Korea must do certain things?
My question here, though, is this about testing the U.S. relationship with China? You need to do this for us. Is this about actual regional nuclear security? Or is this about actually some relationship between the United States and North Korea?
You know, I think it's about the second one. I think it really is about regional security. That's what China's interests are concerned here. That's why China is not interested in North Korea continuing its current activities. So I think all those other things are just kind of, you know, peripheral issues. It's really about the regional nuclear security of Northeast Asia.
And we'll be trying to figure out what this cryptic statement is out of Pyongyang this morning, which may suggest they want face-to-face talks with the U.S. All of a sudden, we may be on a different platform there. Regional security is certainly on the mind in the Middle East. Rob Watson, Robert Gates, defense secretary, is in Israel to meet with the prime minister and the defense minister there. There's a slew of diplomats on their way to the region. First of all, what do you make of this full-court press regionally in the Middle East, Rob?
Well, I don't think there's any doubt that this is physical evidence, if you like, of the Obama administration's determination to try and push through some kind of a peace agreement, a wider peace agreement in the Middle East.
And do we think here that the Iran nuclear question has played possibly into the hands of the Obama administration, in that if they can demonstrate to the Israelis that they can make progress on Iran nukes, that the quid pro quo is going to be some progress regionally on the Palestinian question?
Well, I guess the way I'd put it is rather like this, John, and that is that I think that the United States, the reason why Bob Gates is there, is partly this overall security guarantee to the Israelis on every front, saying to them effectively, look, we know we've been asking you to do some awkward things, some difficult things. We know that there are certain things you're worried about, but hey, don't worry. We're going to continue to be your best security buddy, and we're going to continue to supply you with whatever the most advanced weapons you need to protect yourselves.
And here's Hillary Clinton talking about that.
Israel is a sovereign nation. Any sovereign nation facing what it considers to be an existential threat, as successive Israeli governments have characterized the possibility of Iran having a nuclear weapon would mean to them, is not going to listen to other nations.
Now, would you say, Rob Watson, that that's a suggestion that Israel can go it alone with Iran, or that this is a team effort, or that there's some sort of specific quid pro quo? Clinton did mention when she was on her Asian trip last week that there was some thought of a security shield that, the U.S. would put up over the region. Where does that stand?
How you wish sometimes these people would really spell out what they meant, eh? Well, I'm not sure that I'd go
wrong
as far as
profession.
To say.
Wrong profession.
I don't think I'd go quite as far as to say it was a green light, but I certainly think that perhaps the United States thinks it's kind of useful in its efforts to try and persuade the Iranians to back away from developing nuclear weapons to be able to say, well, you know, I mean, the Israelis, they're deeply worried and, you know, they're a sovereign nation and, you know, maybe we won't be able to rein them in. I mean, I still find it very difficult at the bottom of my heart to think that the Israelis would go ahead with a strike against Iran unless they knew that they'd had at least Washington's tacit approval. I mean, if you remember sometime last year when the Israelis were getting very fidgety about the Iranians, the head of CENTCOM made it pretty clear to Israel that a strike on Iran would not be helpful.
All right, quickly on Afghanistan, there is a suggestion this morning that perhaps the Afghan government is willing to allow a ceasefire with the Taliban in a particular province in Afghanistan to allow the presidential elections to proceed. Is that a sort of timeout in the war in Afghanistan?
Well, it could be really interesting. If that was repeated in other parts of Afghanistan, then you've really got a very, very different dynamic, and clearly I'm sure the Afghan government would like that. I mean, there doesn't seem to be much sign of it in other parts of Afghanistan, but clearly if it was repeated, that would be big news indeed. And it's interesting that Britain's foreign secretary has been talking, or I should say re-emphasizing, the need for, in the long term, for there to be political reconciliation in Afghanistan, that no matter how many Taliban the Brits and the Americans kill, unless you bring the majority of them back into the system and get them to drop their weapons, well, then you're stuffed.
Right. Well, again, something to watch on the agenda all week here. Rob Watson, our partners at the BBC in London. Thank you, Rob, for being with us. And Marcus Mabry, before we go on Washington, good news. It seems Sotomayor will be confirmed this week. We expect a vote on that this week, but also health care will continue. And for the Obama administration, that's not necessarily going to be good news.
Well, you know, Sotomayor's likely confirmation out of the committee on Tuesday certainly is good news for the Obama administration. It's going to be interesting to see on health care. As long as the Democrats continue to negotiate with the Democrats, that is great news for the Republicans, because the Democrats themselves have not yet come to a deal that they all can back. It's very interesting. I think there's going to be a relationship between these two this week, and I think the Republicans will use it. It's going to be interesting to see how they do it and in what context. But I think they're going to use, you know, Sotomayor. She's going being elevated to the bench, even over some Republican votes, including Orrin Hatch,
right.
The Utah senator, for the first time in 33 years, voting against a nominee.
Yeah, I was surprised.
As if she were somehow so extraordinary. Ordinarily incompetent and just outrageous, and this president is incredible that he would dare to do this. You know, kind of the Republican rap on Obama has been he's overambitious, he's taking on too many things, trying to do too many big things at once. I think they're going to wrap up now. Sotomayor is an example of that, his overreaching. Healthcare, his overreaching. He's clearly a liberal. This guy's out of control. And I think they'll also be using subtly the Skip Gates, Gates Gate from last week. Reaching out to white male voters in particular in states like Indiana, Pennsylvania, who may have voted for Obama last time, to remind them that this guy is not like you and me.
So let's back up a second there. So the Gates issue was last week. I mean, I was on vacation last week. I sort of missed the whole thing, but I could tell that it dominated discussion.
Yeah.
If it doesn't proceed into this week as a discussion point, it suggests, as you're saying, a political vulnerability for President Obama going forward?
Absolutely. Any president who'd stand up there and from the bully pulpit say that any police department acted stupidly, they will be using that clip and that idea, that notion that this is something that would not, that those white male voters in particular in those swing states would not agree with. They would not have that perspective as Obama. And that will be, they'll use that again and again on different issues. Healthcare, Sotomayor, Wise Latina, et cetera, et cetera.
Except Reverend Wright, that looked significant in the middle of the campaign, but it didn't ultimately have long-term sort of legs, shall we say. Do you think the Gates thing could suffer the same fate as the Reverend Wright issue?
I think only if the economy were actually to turn around. And everyone agrees. The economy is probably, the market certainly seems to suggest it. The administration has suggested it. Seems to be bottoming out.
And because it's a police officer, it's a bigger issue in some ways. Marcus Mabry, international business editor for The New York Times. Times, and Rob Watson, BBC defense and security correspondent from London. Thanks to you both. There's the agenda.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. On this Monday morning, we want to elevate the discussion around the breakfast table for families. Family values, you remember that term, is kind of a political term from the 1980s, but family values means maybe something different when you come home and watch this going on television.
I get what I want all the time.
I go shopping as much as I possibly can.
How much have we spent?
So far today, you've spent over $69,000.
What are families to make of My Super Sweet 16? It's the MTV reality show all about kids having super sweet 16 parties. And are kids getting their values from these shows? Because they're certainly aimed at young people. Let's face it, reality TV programming actually began with little kids. There was Bozo the Clown. Those kinds of shows were the original reality TV. Real World, MTV did that show back in the 1980s. But nowadays, the question is, are kids learning their values from reality TV, or are they just sort of seeing themselves in the people in shows like John and Kate Plus 8, which my kids know more about than I really would care to have them know? It's a dilemma for a father, and here to help me with it is Kate Daly, who writes the Human Condition blog at Newsweek.com. Good morning, Kate. Thanks for helping me out here.
Good morning.
You know, I am right about one thing, and that is reality TV began with kids eons ago, but the new reality TV involves some subjects and some issues that are maybe a little more challenging for parents. But I guess the question for you from me is, are kids seeing this stuff for the first time in these shows, or are they just seeing themselves? Because these issues are on the table in text messages with kids everywhere.
Well, I mean, when you deal with reality TV, the thing you have to remember is that it's not even quite reality. It's kind of this simulacra where you have teenagers kind of, you know, living out sort of the highest degrees of excess, of consumerism, of things that look real, but in fact are pretty staged and overproduced. So I think it's important to draw a line with teenagers as to what is real behavior and what is kind of put on for the camera.
But they kind of know it. I mean, they knew the real world was sort of staged. I mean, they know that, you know, American Idol is not really even real. What are the shows that we're talking about here that maybe raise the family discussion around the table to something a little more serious?
Well, you have shows. There's kind of two different types of shows. You have shows like NYC Prep, where you see kids just running around like little spoiled jerks, kind of treating New York City like their own private playground, which raises questions of, you know, values and what kind of, you know, consumerism, what you want your kids to learn. And then you have shows like 16 and Pregnant, which 20 years ago would have been called a documentary and shown in your health class on a rainy day. And that's something where they have kind of a lot less of a sugarcoating on issues like teen pregnancy.
Well, here's a clip from that show. MTV again, 16 and Pregnant.
Macy, how did you tell your mom you were pregnant?
Your text message.
That's awful.
She said, well, if you're joking, it's not funny. If you're for real, we are not having this conversation via text message.
You have to admit, that's a lot different than the pregnancy show that, like, All in the Family might have done in the 60s or 70s or 80s.
Right. Well, even in, you know, the 2000s, you were seeing as early as, you know, 2 years ago, a lot of glamorization of teen pregnancy. You saw Jamie Lynn Spears having a baby and then 6 months later popping up in Star Magazine looking great, you know, at the Kids' Choice Awards. And so I think that this is a really kind of veritas, very realistic look at teen pregnancy, which is a good thing.
Which is a good thing. And how old are you, roughly?
I'm in my 20s.
In your
20s,
and I'm in my 50s. Can we get somebody in here who, like, actually knows about what this is all about in relationship with teens? Our intern, Grace, I think, is here. Grace, it's okay for you to come in here. Yeah.
It's enough to make my dated references sound even more dated.
Grace, so sit down over there. All right, you are a fan of these reality shows?
I am.
Is that right?
Probably more than
most people should be.
More than most people should be. All right, so then the question to you is, what is the message that you are getting or looking for when you see shows like, My Super Sweet 16 or New York Prep or the pregnancy show we just referred to?
Well, a lot of it is it's just pure farce, and, you know, you watch it for its entertainment value. So for me, shows...
Entertainment value meaning those people are weird, they're not like me.
Right. Well, I mean, it's just human nature that, you know, you get a certain amount of pleasure from watching someone and thinking, I am a better person than you are.
And that's, so that's the entertainment value.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I see. And how old are you? How old are you, brother?
I'm just turning 17.
Just turning 17.
Well, and that raises an interesting point as to whether or not these shows might not teach your kids, you know, how to run around New York City and run up daddy's credit card, but it does, you might want to talk to them about issues of empathy and what they're kind of learning in terms of watching people making snap judgments. Like you said, with John and Kate Plus 8, you have people going, oh, well, she's just a shrew. She deserved what she got. Or, you know, he's just a jerk running around. And it's very tempting to kind of boil it down to sort of stereotypes and snap judgments in a way that robs people sometimes of compassion.
Well, but it's so very easy for me to think that my kids are actually getting some sort of role model from a show like this. And you're saying that actually the opposite is true.
Yeah.
Reassure me as a 17-year-old, Grace, that in fact, the fact that my kids know all about Kate and what is his name?
John.
Kate and John plus 8 know all about this is not a problem for me.
Yeah, it definitely sort of makes you a bit jaded and see, you think that, you know, you're a better person than everyone else. And as soon as you see someone, you can judge them on, you know, the car they drive and their accent, just because these shows reinforce those stereotypes to such a high degree.
Hmm. And John, I can probably guarantee that your daughters watching John and Kate plus 8 aren't thinking, I want to grow up to be a divorced mother of octuplets.
I don't even...
I'm pretty sure
Thank
that's
you.
Not the takeaway.
You've made my day. Yeah. But they actually don't watch it. They actually get the information from, like, the magazines and the information flows not just from the TV. All right, so last question to both of you. Is this a genre that we're seeing just peaking now and is going to be over in 3 years, or is this something that's going to be with us for, like, a generation?
And with reality television, you can't stop it. You can only hope to contain it. It's really cheap to produce. It's really popular. It requires
a lot less
manpower.
Bush said about Iraq, I think.
Exactly. So, I mean, reality TV is here to stay, and the question is just, how are you going to talk to your kids about it?
Last word, Grace, before we send you back into the, like, Xeroxing machine.
Well, I can only sort of hope that it gets sort of a little more realistic in the future.
So you want more realism?
Yeah, like, it's sometimes painful to realize that you're just judging people in the 22 minutes or whatever they're on reality TV.
And a harsh judge she is. But get over jadedness. That's a good lesson for any 17-year-old. Grace Rosen, teenage fan of reality TV, one of our interns and a senior at Princeton High School in New Jersey. Kate Daly writes the Human Condition blog at Newsweek.com, covers health and lifestyle, and you can see a blog post at thetakeaway.org later today on this subject. Thanks to both of you. And now it's time for headlines from Femi OK.
Thank you very much. 29 minutes past the hour. House Democrats come together to talk health care in a full caucus meeting this afternoon. Leaders are expected to go through the health care bill section by section. President Obama will keep pitching health care this week. The president heads to Virginia and North Carolina for health care stump speeches. But first, he kicks off 2 days of talks with Chinese representatives in Washington. We will hear from the president at the start of those talks next hour, and actually in about an hour from now. And this comes as North Korea is now indicating that it would take part in direct talks with the United States. Last week, North Korea described multilateral talks on its nuclear program as being dead. In Afghanistan, there's news this morning that the government and the Taliban have agreed to a ceasefire in just one province. That's to allow the upcoming presidential election to take place there smoothly. Let's look at top stories making headlines.
Afghan story is really interesting. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. You know, we hear it every morning in this recession, the voice of a man fighting for his job.
I am as disgusted about it as you are. And I think it's absolutely critical as we go forward that we put in a new system that will make sure that when a firm does not succeed in the marketplace, that it fails.
The man in this case was Ben Bernanke. He, of course, is the chairman of the Federal Reserve, and he showed up at a town hall meeting in Kansas City to face tough questions from people who are talking about the economy and are thinking about the economy as we all are. But the question is it a teachable moment for Americans trying to learn about the recession, or is it a campaign by Ben Bernanke to fight for his job? His term as Fed chairman expires in January. It's a question of tactics. It's also a question of learning about the economy. And Edmund Andrews, New York Times economics reporter, joins us now from Kansas City. This was an unprecedented moment of public access for a Federal Reserve chief, and maybe it's not Ben Bernanke style, but certainly the chairman of the Federal Reserve is not known for being forthcoming to the press, especially at a town meeting. How did this play out?
Well, I think this was an extraordinary moment in the Fed's evolution toward being a more open institution. Bernanke feels that he must get out there and communicate much more than the Fed has traditionally done, partly because the Fed is doing so many more things and has so much more to explain for itself. It's not just raising or lowering interest rates anymore. It's getting in the middle of rescues of, you know, failing financial institutions, and it's stepping in to lend money where banks have not been able to do so. So there's a lot going on there. But also, the Fed is in an institutional struggle right now as the Obama administration and the Congress figure out how to overhaul the system of financial regulation. And depending on how that reform takes place, the Fed would end up either gaining or losing power, or both, depending on the mix of moves.
Well, it's a classic sort of interagency turf battle in Washington. It's just unusual that the Fed would ever be involved in such a thing, since it's so sort of insulated from the traditional machinations of Washington. Let's talk about Bernanke himself for a moment. He is trained as a teacher. I mean, listen to this, and let's assess how he did with just regular folks asking questions.
I was not going to be the Federal Reserve chairman who presided over the second Great Depression. And for that reason, I had to hold my nose and stop those firms from failing.
Edmund Andrews of the New York Times, is he good with students if the students are American taxpayers?
The people that I talked to last night seemed fairly pleased with his answers, and a lot of them said that he spoke very clearly and made his job comprehensible to them. But whether this really gets traction with voters at large, with the public at large, is kind of hard to say.
We should say it's not organized by him. I mean, he did show up. It was organized by PBS. It's going to be rolled out all week as part of a special on the NewsHour on PBS. If he is in a battle for his job, it's with Larry Summers, correct? Not with Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner. And again, we're speculating as to whether he's actually in a battle for his job, right?
Well, you do get the feeling he would like to stay in that job and be nominated for another term as chairman. No question about that. He has never said it. The question almost came up last night, but not quite, and he didn't have to answer it, and he didn't, whether he wanted to stay in. But we assume that he would like another term if it was offered to him. And, there's a presumption that Larry Summers, the director of the White House National Economic Council, would be one of his chief rivals,
right,
for that.
Well, Edmund Andrews, thank you very much. Covering the Kansas City town meeting of Ben Bernanke. He's a New York Times economics reporter, and he joined us from Kansas City. Joining us now is Peter Morici, economist and business professor at the University of Maryland, on the line from Alexandria, Virginia. First of all, Peter, did you hear any news in Ben Bernanke's town meeting?
No, not really. It's the sort of things that he has been saying. The real news was that he had a town meeting, and although the PBS may have organized it, as you pointed out, he went along with the invitation. It's not something that he had to do. It's something that he wanted to do, and the real question is why.
All right, but we can sort of find that out later on in the week as Washington assesses Ben Bernanke's performance. My question for you is, I go on vacation for a week, and all of a sudden, all of the market indices are way above 9,000, way above, you know, in like record territory for the last couple of months. Am I a leading indicator of the economy?
I guess so. I mean, maybe you should go on vacation more often.
Thank
and
you,
the
Peter.
Recession will end.
Thank
I mean,
you, Peter.
You kind of led with your chin, and there you go.
There,
I mean, you weren't Andrews would have been diplomatic, not me.
But it does appear as though people are reassured, or investors are reinsured by banks doing very, very well, which was certainly the story 2 weeks ago.
Actually, I think you're overestimating that. We had a large surge in the market around the TARP that the stress test, around the time the stress test results came out. The market went down twice, once because of the recession, and then there was a panic last November over the solvency of the banks. And prior to this rally, we had recovered a lot of that. I said on Kudlow, if you'll excuse me for mentioning CNBC, the night the stress tests were results were released, that come the end of June, the market would start to smell the end of the recession. The first people to know a recession is ending are the analysts, because they start to see it in what they see in individual companies 2 quarters out, and they're starting to smell, true or not, an end of a recession, and so the buying has begun.
Well, the only thing about that, I would say, is that there's no chance whatsoever that Kudlow allowed you to complete that entire thought on CNBC. But
actually, he did.
No kidding.
He did.
We'll have to get the audio.
It was a substitute
host
anchor that
night
in May.
Well, then it doesn't count. Then it doesn't count if it's on Kudlow. But let's talk specifically.
All right, you want to be that way, be that way. This is what I see.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's great, but let's think this week. What are the issues for earnings this week that are going to, again, increase this sort of smell that the economy is ending on the part of certain investors?
Well, you've got to have more good earnings news for it to keep going. And the fact of the matter is the market is now pretty high. Some pullback or some vacillation over the next several weeks is very possible and in fact, likely, because the market, you know, is out there. I mean, I can't say that it's ahead of itself. I think it's going to grow some more by the end of the year. But I think it's going to need some time to digest everything that's going on.
And it appears as though inflationary concerns about this entire sort of intervention in the economy by the Fed and Bernanke and all of the sort of things we were discussing in the financial meltdown, you know, months ago, is really muted. It's barely even there in the market, it seems to me.
Well, there's been a little uptick in the yield on inflation-adjusted treasuries, but not really a lot. I mean, there is concern about it, but there's confidence that as long as Bernanke's in the job, he'll pull back the liquidity as needed, as he's doing right now already. My feeling is if Bernanke stays in the job, inflation will be tame.
All right.
If the president gets to put Romer in there, watch out.
All right, Peter Morici, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Peter Morici, economist and business professor at the University of Maryland, our Peter Gunn.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Now a look at something that's faded from the headlines, but certainly not from the significance in world affairs, specifically in Iraq. How much better is the security situation in Iraq as American forces are, we've been told, moving out of Iraqi cities?
The Iraqi police have come a long way since the beginning of our deployment here. Their proficiency and their ability to get the job done is going to work me out of a job, which is good.
It's the view of U.S. Commanding Officer Captain Brian Panero, who's in charge of an area just south of Mosul in Iraq. Gabriel Gatehouse has spent last week embedded with U.S. troops in Mosul, and we can talk to him from Baghdad now. The embed gave you quite a window, Gabriel, into the security situation in Iraq. What really stood out to you as far as the situation is, as far as the situation exists on the ground since U.S. forces seem to have redeployed?
I think it's very interesting now the way the interaction is taking place between U.S. and Iraqi forces. But because there is now this interaction, the Iraqis notionally at least are very much in the lead and the Americans following there. So there was some crossover. Now, going into Mosul, it still very much feels like a city at war, even though much of the destruction that's still visible, houses reduced to rubble, buildings pockmarked by bullets left over from the invasion 6 years ago. Very little of it has been reconstructed. Now, I went out on a joint patrol with American and Iraqi forces, notionally on a reconstruction project. The Americans have a number of projects there. This one, we were supposed to be overseeing the clear-up of a large bit of wasteland, lots of trash lying about there. There was certainly plenty to do, open sewage and stuff. But clearly, the 130,000 US troops that are still left in Iraq are more than just heavily armed garbage men. So I think this is also an opportunity for the Americans, after the handover on the 30th of June, to still get their eyes and ears and boots back on the ground to see for themselves what the security situation is like.
Gabriel, explain to me, are U.S. troops in their sort of conversations with you saying, yeah, Gabriel, this is winding down, look over here, da-da-da-da-da-da, or are they kind of scratching their heads as to what it would be like if the U.S. was suddenly out of the picture?
Yeah, it very much depends on who you talk to and whether they feel like they're talking for the record or off the record. Mm. For the record, the line is very much, the Iraqi security forces have, since the 30th of June, been taking the initiative. They've got much better. We haven't seen the spike in violence that we expected around the handover. Off the record, some people are indeed saying that they don't know how much the Iraqi security forces can be trusted to what deal they're infiltrated by militants. So it's a double-edged question.
I'm confused by one thing here, Gabriel Gatehouse, and that is that we were told here in the United States the U.S. forces were pulling out of Iraqi cities. Mosul, as far as I understand, is a city in Iraq. Would you say that the U.S. has pulled out of Iraqi cities based on your embed?
Well, they're not based inside the city anymore. They're based outside of it. Now, what I was on was a joint patrol. Now, again, you get a lot of confusing information.
So they commute to work? Is that what you're saying?
Kind of. It's not really so much commuting. What they do is they go in, first of all, to the local Iraqi security forces outpost, and they ask permission. They ask permission to go in. They say, we want to go in and check on this project. And then there's a lot of bargaining going on, who's going with whom and where they're going. And then eventually they're allowed in. So they can take a look, but they have to leave again at the end of the day.
Well, there's a picture. Fascinating stuff. Gabriel Gatehouse, BBC correspondent in Baghdad, embedded with U.S. forces in Iraq, in the city of Mosul. Thank you very much, Gabriel.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort, and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Coming up, who's saying goodbye and who's saying hello to Alaska Governor Sarah Palin now that she's ex-governor? Right after headlines with Femi Okeh.
Thanks, John. 12 minutes to the top of the hour, almost. Healthcare leads the agenda in Washington this morning. There's an extensive meeting later today for House Democrats. Some say a bill could pass the House this week, but conservative-leaning Democrats want changes. D.C. is also talking China today. Top Chinese officials are in town for high-level meetings. President Obama kicks off the talks. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner are also involved. Financial, security and environmental issues are all on the table. Defence Secretary Robert Gates won't be there. He's in the Middle East today, where Iran is a hot topic. Gates says that Iran should respond to US diplomatic overtures by September. Also today, Israel refuses to rule out a military strike on Iran. Now, opposition supporters in Iran are asking for a permit to hold a ceremony for those killed in post-election clashes with authorities. Opposition candidate Mir Hussein Mousavi wants to hold it on Thursday. The exiled Honduran president Manuel Zelaya, is camping outside of his country's border in a bid to get back to power. He's also criticizing the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, for calling his trip reckless. Gas prices are down around about 7 cents a gallon over the past 2 weeks. Here's Trilby Lundberg, who tracks the nation's gas prices.
The price continued falling from earlier lower crude oil prices, but that's about to be reversed. Oil prices are up about $8 per barrel in these 2 weeks, but are not yet passed through to the consumer.
The Lundberg survey has the average price of regular at $2.49 a gallon. And finally, small rodents are worth more than magical British children. British children, small rodents are slightly ahead. At least this weekend, G-Force is a movie about heroic guinea pigs. It took the number one movie slot from Harry Potter and Half-Blood Prince. If you haven't seen it yet, here's a taster.
This is a rodent.
Guinea pig, sir. Don't say that. They get highly offended. You know their DNA is 98.7% identical to humans, right?
No, how would I know that?
$32 million at the box office. Can't argue with that.
Rodents won. Magical British kids, is that what you say?
Yes,
zero?
Zero.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, she was once the running mate of John McCain. Then she became the ex-vice presidential candidate. Now she's officially the ex-governor of Alaska. Sarah Palin has resigned, which means she's just an ordinary citizen like you and me, right? She resigned yesterday, gave a speech in Fairbanks, Alaska, was greeted by a chorus of cheers, some boos. To many, her reasons for leaving and what she plans to do next are a little bit unclear, and she tried to clear that up yesterday.
So we are here today at a changing of the guard. Now, people who know me and they know how much I love this state, some still are choosing not to hear why I made the decision to chart a new course to advance the state. And it should be so obvious to you.
So obvious. Obvious? Is it obvious to you, Jimmy Bice, who's a blogger and founder of the Sundry Shack culture and political blog from the Libertarian Right? Jimmy?
Sure. I don't have a huge problem figuring it out. It seems to me that what she's really saying is that it's really tough to do your job when you're in the back end of your normal term, and you're taking as much fire as you can from the left. You have to spend time defending yourself. You can't spend a lot of time actually governing your state. To me, that, you know, it makes some sense. I know a lot of people won't agree with it, but it does make sense.
I mean, is it really obvious that she's charting a new course for the state of Alaska, or is she advancing her own career?
Well, I think it's obvious that she's getting out of the way of Alaska, and that to me seems to be good for Alaska, that she's just moving out of the way so that Alaska can do whatever it needs to do without her, either her fame or her notoriety, impeding it one way or the other.
That is the most coherent statement I've heard yet. She's doing something for Alaska because she's moving out of the way. I'm wondering if there's a lot of people in Alaska who would agree with that. Dan Bros, news reporter for KUAC-FM in Fairbanks, Alaska. Good morning, Dan, and would you agree?
Well, I mean, the thing about Sarah Palin is, you know, she started her career or her term as governor with such high hopes. People really saw her as a breath of fresh air. And she's taken this major detour last fall as a vice presidential candidate. And ever since then, she really has never come back to Alaska in full. She's been distracted. Much, you know, you can blame that on her as much as the national media that's picked her up as, you know, a favorite target, as well as a celebrity that they like to celebrate.
Dan Bros, you were at the event in Fairbanks yesterday, right?
Yes.
I wonder if you could help explain this exchange. We only have one side of it here. It seems that she was referring to someone particular in the audience. Listen to this.
It is because I love Alaska this much, sir, that I feel that it is my duty to avoid the unproductive, typical politics as usual, lame duck session in one's last year in office. How does that benefit you?
Dan Bross, you're a reporter for KUAC-FM in Fairbanks. What was she responding to there?
Well, you know, it was hard to hear what this heckler was saying, but, you know, my assumption is that he was critical of her quitting the job, basically, before she was done, accusing her, I'm guessing, of being a quitter, but you couldn't really make out what this guy was saying.
Right.
But the governor certainly, or the ex-governor now, certainly addressed him, saying, you know, it's people like you picking on me that have made it impossible for me to do my job.
Well, if it's the end of Palin in Alaska, and people will maybe feel some sort of relief that at least the ambiguity about the governorship is over with for the time being, Jimmy Bice, it's the beginning. It's sort of hello to Sarah Palin for the rest of the country, now looking at her as a for sure contender for something. What is she going for here? And what do your bloggers say?
That's a great question. I don't know that you're going to actually find any blogger consensus on what Sarah is going to do now. And I think that's as much because the road is as wide open for her as it's ever been, as much as it is that Sarah has always kind of charted her own course when it comes to her political future.
Well, Jimmy, let me ask you about that. You say it's wide open. I mean, looking at that news conference yesterday, or that event yesterday, it really seemed to me like kind of a swan song for everything. I wonder if it's narrowing rather than widening for her.
I don't know. I don't know that there's any reason it has to narrow. I mean, we've seen in politics that you can endure an awful lot and still come back and make a real big splash on the national scene. You can fail. You can even fail big and come back. You can be a short-time senator and run for president, for goodness sake. There's nothing entirely out of the question when it comes to national politics. But I honestly have no idea where she's going. I'm actually kind of interested to see where she's going to end up in 2 or 3 or 4 years.
Dan Bross, is there any sort of per-event take in terms of what Sarah Palin might be worth to a GOP candidate or some political action committee that wants to invite her to a fundraiser dinner?
I mean, there's a lot of money out there for Sarah Palin. I mean, she performs well when you put her on stage and she's got the stage set for her. In other words, she's calling the shots. We saw that at the Republican convention last year. And again and again, when things are set up for her, she can perform really well. So clearly she has some opportunity out there. Whether she can build the kind of knowledge and support that can take her to something like a presidential nomination, well, that remains to be seen.
And there's plenty of time for that. We mentioned at the top of the hour that actually, we quoted Sarah Palin calling for the media to not make things up in honor of soldiers who defend the freedom of speech in the United States. How's that sort of don't make things up pledge going at the Fairbanks sort of media press corps there, Dan?
Well, I mean, she was very clear that this was for some members of the media. And she actually said that twice, that she was kind of singling out, I assume, a few reporters maybe who've taken some liberties and you know, portrayed her or her family in a poor light and didn't have all the facts.
Well, she got a big applause when she called for that, that's for sure. It was
right,
a huge...
I mean, I think people love to beat up on the media, of course. That's a great American pastime.
All right, Dan Bross, news reporter for KUAC in Fairbanks, Alaska. Jimmy Bice, we'll leave it with you. Is campaigning against the media going to work in the internet age?
Oh, yeah. It always seems to work. The media makes a great target sometimes, and there are a lot of people that are not happy with the way the national media works a lot of times. I think they're always a great target.
We're a great target, and we will continue to be so. Thank you so much, blogger and founder of the Sundry Shack Culture and Political Block from the libertarian right. Jimmy Bice writes it. Thanks so much for being with us. And, of course, on Sarah Palin, we're going to hear from you, right?
My name is Philip. I'm from South Mississippi. I think Sarah Palin is absolutely through. Politicians have to be thick-skinned, and she undoubtedly must be part of the kinder, gentler world.
What's your take on any of the stories on The Takeaway? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Our podcast to go means we're on all the time. Like me, I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is The Takeaway.
So last week, healthcare was Obama's Waterloo. This week, what is it? Water ballet?
I like the president, but he's out of control, and he's been leading a stampede of more spending and debt and taxes and government takeovers. And now he's trying to use the same strategy on healthcare.
The debate gets louder and less comprehensible as everyone on Capitol Hill is suddenly thinking about your health care. What they're saying might be hazardous to your health. The doctor's in the house. Don't worry. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Monday, July 27th, 2009. Healthcare is more than a headache for President Obama this morning. More on that in a moment. Also, Lance Armstrong comes in third. He's still a story, though. Takeaway sports mastermind Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen has that and more. Plus, a huge full-scale diplomatic invasion of Israel in the Middle East. Obama sends in the big guns. And when you have a job but still feel like you're unemployed, what is that? Beth Kobliner is here to explain. But first, Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Todd, is anyone making sense on healthcare this week now that the voting deadline seems to be passing?
Well, they're gonna keep trying to make sense. They got lots and lots of meetings. John, if you're wondering if they're making sense, you have to know that there is a five-hour seminar scheduled for House members to come in and learn what this healthcare bill, H.R. 3200, is all about. So if you don't understand it, imagine what it feels like if members of Congress don't understand it.
Is that
they go
the
to
Democrats,
school for 5 hours.
Is that the Democrats' only meeting today?
There are lots of meetings. They're still trying to meet with the conservatives and members of the White House team to try to get a House bill by the end of the week, if possible.
Well, we'll get a consumer angle on this in a moment. Thanks, Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent.
Go, go, Todd Zwillick!
And right now, everything you need to know this morning. In the headlines, it's not all health care inside the Beltway today. In a few minutes, President Obama kicks off high-level talks between the U.S. and China. Plenty on the table, including financial, security, and environmental issues. Sarah Palin is done as governor, at least. Her time in the Alaska State House is now officially over. Her farewell speech gave little hint as to what's next. As we're talking about this morning, Defense Secretary Robert Gates is in the Middle East, as is Special Envoy George Mitchell. Iran and the Israeli-Palestinian peace process are driving those discussions. North Korea appears to be open to new nuke talks. It's out with a new cryptic statement seeming to suggest direct talks with the United States. That's bound to be a subject at the U.S.-China talks going on in Washington. Space Shuttle Endeavour astronauts are floating their way through one last spacewalk this morning. They're undocking from the International Space Station tomorrow. And French President Nicolas Sarkozy, he collapsed on Sunday suddenly while he was jogging. He's now out of the hospital. His doctors say he's okay. In Paris, Alberto Contador is the Tour de France winner. Lance Armstrong took third place. Contador has won two of the last three tours. Who would have thought? Global stars? No, they're just guinea pigs. Small rodents are worth more than British children. For the last weekend in the movies, G-Force, a movie about heroic guinea pigs, took the number one movie slot, $32 million. Asian markets up. The Dow and S&P begin at 9093, S&P 979, respectively. The NASDAQ starts at 1965. If I say furlough, what do you say? Well, you don't have a job. At least you're not getting paid. But if you're furloughed, what's it like? We have some advice coming up, but we want to hear your story if you're furloughed. 877-8MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
The only thing bipartisan about the measures so far is the opposition to them.
Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, speaking on CNN's State of the Union on Sunday, may be right about that. He's talking about health care. The only thing that lawmakers are agreeing on is opposition to the Obama plan to reform health care. The rhetoric has sped up, even though the progress toward a vote has slowed down. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, continues with us now. Todd, I'm desperately trying to get a consumer angle here, and I'm demanding that you help me. If I'm a person who's concerned with my health insurance or just my health care, depending on what you want to call it, what do I keep my eye on here?
Well, there are a couple. Well, John, there are hundreds of moving parts in terms of what consumers should worry about. It's just the reality of it. I mean, like we mentioned before, there's a 5-hour seminar for members today to learn all about this. Now they're probably they're
big
talking mostly about
there.
Cost. I think they're allowed to just roll in and roll out whenever they want to, but Mondays are pretty slow on the Hill, so they should devote all 5 hours to it.
What's the price tag look like at this point of this plan that's being considered?
Just about $1 trillion.
Right.
Now, don't forget, there is no plan capital P because we have several bills still in process.
Right.
The bill everybody's talking about this week, of course, is mostly the House bill because that's the one that could get a vote this week by the end of the week. And that one's not exactly slowing down. Nancy Pelosi says she's going to have a vote on it, and we'll see if she can follow through. The Senate has definitely slowed down. They're still negotiating like crazy, but they won't vote until September. I know there are a number of issues. Health insurance coverage. Will you be able to get coverage? Will your employer have to give you coverage? And in fact, the whole point of these bills is to require people to have coverage, not only individuals, but also for employers, most employers, except for very small ones, to offer it.
How's that going to work? Let me just stop you there. I mean, is it going to be, I mean, with your driver's license, you can't get registered unless you show proof of insurance. What are they going to stop you from doing if you can't show proof of health care insurance based on how this legislation is evolving?
You got to pay a fine.
Uh-huh.
And the fines are different in every bill. In the Senate Health Committee bill, most people would pay about $750 a year if they refuse to get health insurance. The House bill works a little bit differently. It's sort of a sliding scale depending on income. If you're a lower income person, up to 400% of the poverty level, you actually get quite a bit of federal help to get insurance. So
that's
what
the subsidy part.
That's the subsidy part. That's one of the subsidy parts.
Well, hugely helpful. I mean, a fine. I get it. $750 fine. Okay, that is great. You know, the other consumer angle that I dug deep to try to find involved this that David Axelrod referred to yesterday, and I know you're all over this particular issue. It involves taxing, you know, sort of a golden, you know, really high-value employer-offered health care plans.
What he said was, that this was an intriguing idea to put an excise tax on high-end healthcare policies like the ones that the executives at Goldman Sachs have, the $40,000 policies. His big interest is in keeping the yoke of this, the burden of this, off of the middle class.
Now, if you're a consumer who works at a place like Goldman Sachs and has a really high-end healthcare plan, are you worried at this moment, this morning, about being taxed for that healthcare benefit as income?
Boogeyman alert. Like all of a sudden this is all about Goldman Sachs, right?
Yeah, right.
buzzword of the week. It depends. Yes. And the answer is what will be the definition of this gold-plated Cadillac plan? When they first started this debate, it was like $14,000. They were going to tax anything above that. Right now, taxpayers subsidize insurance. Nobody pays tax on their private insurance, and economists think that's one of the biggest things wrong with the system. They need revenue for this plan, John, $1 trillion, and they got to raise the money.
Right.
So they have to find a value of insurance above which they can tax it in a politically palatable way. So going after, quote, Goldman's – I mean, who's on the side of Goldman Sachs right now? You? Me? They just posted record profits after being on TARP for a year. So calling it the Goldman Sachs tax, I suppose, is a politically great way to do it.
But the GOP has a legitimate issue, and that is if it opens the door to those plans being taxed, virtually every benefit could be taxed ultimately, and that is something that will play for the GOP, correct?
It could, but that's certainly not going to happen in this debate because the president has said and Democrats have said clearly this bill is to help the middle class. So you don't want to turn around and start taxing health benefits of working everyday people. They're trying to keep this health benefits tax in the realm of the rich. The House is talking about a surtax on millionaires to fund this bill, which is on people who make it, households that make $1 million a year or more. Employers would have to pay a fine if they don't offer insurance, and they're trying to keep that out of small employers.
Thanks for the help trying to find some consumer angles. I think you did a heck of a job there, Todd, and that's why we call
John.
Every week. Todd Zwillick, of course, the Takeaway's Washington correspondent. Joining us now for more on this is Kathleen Hall Jamison, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. First of all, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You know, this is a really interesting debate, and I'm wondering if what's going on in Washington about health care now relates to the fact that this is really a debate about what is the appropriate role of government in something as important to everybody as health care. And it's also the most ambitious change in policy that the government has even attempted in quite some time. Would you say that's why the rhetoric is the way it is?
the rhetoric is the way it is in part for those reasons. And that's the reason that the Obama representatives are framing this as a public option as opposed to a government-run program, and why opponents are calling it government takeover and socialized medicine. If you focus on the nature of the government role here, it becomes more difficult for the rhetoric to focus on the Obama objective: slow down the cost curve, be deficit neutral in 10 years, and then ultimately expand coverage.
So is this debate a useful sort of linguistic exercise, as, you know, it's a health care plan? No, it's a health insurance reform plan. Or I mean, help us to understand the way the language works, how close, you know, or if there's any evidence that they're making progress toward real reform.
If you look at the news coverage as your indicator of what's getting through to the public, what you see is that the Obama administration and the press coverage are both focused now on cost control more so than increasing coverage, and on how you pay for it rather than what you would receive if this happened, what would be good about this for you. And the focus on cost control, slowing the cost curve for the Obama administration, makes strategic sense if by doing so he communicates, and bill advocates communicate, that the individual with insurance is going to be benefited by this plan, and not simply being asked to pay for it in some form at some level.
So that's fascinating.
In order to provide insurance for others.
You're saying that if we've advanced to the idea of price tag, we've already leapfrogged over some really much more difficult issues.
We've also leapfrogged over some of the parts of the debate that could be so complex that a reasonable person isn't going to understand them. When you start to talk about insurance exchanges and independent Medicare advisory councils, you're now in a realm in which the language is new, unfamiliar, and as a result, extremely confusing. But when somebody says, well, don't worry, we're going to be taxing Cadillac gold-plated plans, first you step back and say, that doesn't sound like it's mine. But secondly, you're now back into an English language exchange, but one in which one side benefits dramatically. Some people who might be taxed under this proposal might not call their policies Cadillac gold-plated or Goldman Sachs plans.
Who's doing better, do you think, in this debate, the advocates for reform or the people who are calling it an out-of-control stampede?
At the moment, the group that's doing the best, or the organization doing the best, is the Congressional Budget Office. Because we have an environment in which when each side offers an argument, there's still a place that one can go to find evidence that neither side strongly attempts to discredit. And when the Congressional Budget Office, focusing on cost, said first that the Obama plan wasn't going to be decreasing the deficit or even deficit neutral, it might in fact add to it, and then secondly, that the second mechanism the Obama administration had talked about, independent Medicare Advisory Council, wasn't really going to produce particularly great savings in the short term. That agency stood up, entered the debate, and both sides acknowledged that it offered real evidence, and it advanced the debate forward. When the Congressional Budget Office first focused on the problem with the deficit and the plans moving forward, the Obama administration responded by saying, well, they hadn't scored the independent Medicare Advisory Council. They couldn't because it wasn't before it. When it was put before it, it advanced the debate one more step by saying, yes, but only $2 billion in the first 4 years. That's not enough to accomplish what the Obama administration expects.
So what you're seeing here is government being held accountable. At least the CBO makes a claim, and then officials, legislators respond by changing the policy implications.
And that's the way you'd like the system to work.
It's a good thing.
It's actually an example of democracy in action. In most debates about legislation, about political policy proposals, one side offers one set of facts, the other offers the other. The press doesn't know exactly where to go and begins to try to find experts, and nobody goes to common ground. CBO has provided common ground.
Kathleen Hall Jamison, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. This healthcare debate is a sign of healthy democracy. Thanks so much, Kathleen, for that positive headline this morning. Also, lawmakers on the Hill will be spending 5 hours, according to Todd Zwillick, educating themselves on all the complex measures being considered on healthcare. Current price tag, $1 trillion, folks. More on that, of course. We spend way more than 5 hours on healthcare on this program. Coming up next, from Lance Armstrong's failed comeback at the Tour de France to two of baseball's greats inducted into the Hall of Fame. All the weekend sports news with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen coming up in just a few minutes.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
866-869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good Monday, everyone. Lots to talk about in the sports world. And here, Ibrahim Abdelmateen joins us, Takeaway sports contributor right here in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's nice to be back after vacation. Indeed, I followed sports much more on my vacation than I did during the regular sort of news week. We begin, I guess, with the Tour de France. Lance Armstrong is third. Contador wins. Alberto Contador wins. What does it mean?
Well, the real question is, who's Lance Armstrong now? Because Contador is the guy. He's won four of the last Grand Tours. He's the man in cycling, and he's actually has a bid to become one of the best climbers of all time.
Now, Lance Armstrong had this to say in response to some questions from ESPN about his third-place performance.
I think it's answered all those questions. Now, that's for me, and that's for a certain portion of the population that are supporters. There'll still be people that say, you know, oh, but there's that mystery thing that they must have. And when you hear that, there's nothing I can say to that other than, okay.
So there's Lance Armstrong, who's dancing around the issue of sports doping, something that has plagued the bicycling sport and particularly the Tour de France. No positive doping tests in this particular event. Lance Armstrong says, hey, I came in third. That puts it to rest. But it could also be an argument, hey, he didn't come in first, so what's going on?
Well, you also have to remember he's 37 years old. Contador is 24 years old. Contador is a young, brash, energetic. He's almost like a young Lance Armstrong. What you're seeing here is history about to be made.
Now, does this mean that if you don't win seven in a row, that you're nothing at the Tour de France?
You're almost not relevant. I think it depends on, you know, you have to build up a body of wins. And I think that's what Lance Armstrong has done with the sport, is he's set a really high bar.
Now, the huge story, of course, in baseball this weekend is the clock ticking on the trade deadline, which comes up at the end of the month. The best pitcher in baseball, Doc Holliday of the Toronto Blue Jays, is up for a trade. The St. Louis Cardinals, the Philadelphia Phillies, and possibly even the Yankees are in the running here. How does it stand at this point?
Well, right now, no one really knows. It really goes down to Toronto. When they're ready to make a trade, they're going to pick up the phone and make the trade. And right now, they haven't done it. There's a lot of teams that are in the bidding, a lot of teams that can use them. The Mets could use them. A lot of other teams could use them.
Mets can't afford them.
They certainly can't afford them. The Yankees could afford them, but I'm not sure if they're going to give up what they need to give up to get them.
And Toronto said that they would not trade Halliday in the AL East because it would be competition against their own team, but nobody believes that, right?
Which is interesting. Well, they probably get the best trade for him in the AL East, and they started off the AL East great this year. They had a great beginning of the year. They came out
Toronto
of the box. Toronto did great.
And New York's in the lead right now.
Indeed. And now, you know, their precipitous fall has led them to the situation that if they have to end up giving away one of their best pitchers to the team
Two.
In their
they
league,
want Jabba Chamberlain and Hughes, apparently.
And that would be brutal for Toronto.
So maybe it's going to be the Phillies or the St. Louis Cardinals, but let's listen to this. Bud Selig inducting guess who in the Hall of Fame yesterday?
Faster than a speeding bullet, scored more runs, 2,295, stole more bases, 1,406, than any player in history. Combined power, plate discipline, flair, and an uncanny ability to electrify crowds.
Bud Selig can't electrify crowds like Ricky Henderson, who is inducted into the Hall of Fame. Ricky Henderson, for sure, indisputable Hall of Fame numbers. He's a legend as a base stealer.
A lot of people forget that he was a base stealer. He was a speedster, but he also had the most home runs by a leadoff hitter. He had speed and power, and with that combination, you're a first ballot guy.
Although if you're a leadoff hitter and you do lots of home runs, you don't necessarily make a lot of friends on the team.
It's very true. That's
it's
a good
true.
Point.
It's definitely true. Jim Rice also inducted, and that was controversial.
It was only controversial because he wasn't buddy-buddy with guys like me and you. He wasn't cozy up to the press. He was a workman's kind of guy. He went in there. He was the most feared hitter in baseball. It's kind of like saying, you know, if a guy like David Ortiz wasn't able to talk to the press, you'd be like, whoa, you'd be afraid of him. But he definitely deserves to be in the Hall of Fame, and he got in.
underneath the backstory in the Hall of Fame every year, now that we're in this sort of steroid controversy era of baseball, is who's not going to get in. Barry Bonds, Mark McGwire. I mean, Bonds isn't up yet, but McGwire didn't get in again.
Yeah, McGwire is almost probably never going to get in.
Never.
He has the numbers to get in, but his steroid abuse, his steroid use is well known. And he lied to Congress. Precisely. And a lot of these other guys
allegedly
have never been technically tested positive.
Right.
So you can't do it on rumor. That's the problem with this whole thing, is that you have older and younger writers going back and forth about who's in and who's out, but you can't just do it based on rumor.
And I think it's fair to say at this point, Mark McGwire is the Pete Rose of steroids in baseball. Oof. At this point, never going to make it, I think. That's my call. Michael Vick, the NFL is in the news all of a sudden. Vick is out of the hands of the law and perhaps headed back to the NFL. What's going on with Michael Vick?
Well, enter into this conversation Terrell Owens, who just made a call to the unions that the union should step up for Michael Vick. Right now, it's a double jeopardy situation for Michael Vick. The league should let their hands off of the situation and let him compete to see who he can play with.
And the Vick situation, is it like Terrell Owens, where his negatives are possibly a positive for some team that really wants the box office that Vick can produce?
Without a doubt. You're definitely going to get a box office financial success if you bring a guy like Vick into the franchise. The story there of him overcoming this adversity will be a huge one.
Quickly, boxing champion Vernon Forrest is dead. That's a tragedy for boxing. Why?
It's a tragedy because he was a great guy. People, all the recounts and reports of him, it says that he was a good guy for boxing.
And a shooting.
He went out as a shooting, but he went out as a champion, and he was shot in the back, which is tragic.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, all the takeaway sports for a Monday morning, and Femi Oke has our headlines. Good morning, Fem.
Hello there, John. The time is just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. House Democrats come together to talk health care in a full caucus meeting this afternoon. The meeting is scheduled to last 5 hours while leaders go through the health care bill section by section. President Obama will keep pitching health care this week when he heads to Virginia and North Carolina. But first, he kicks off two-day talks with Chinese representatives in Washington. And we will hear from the president in just a couple of minutes. Now, this comes as North Korea is now indicating it would take part in direct talks with the United States. Last week, North Korea described multilateral talks on its nuclear program as being dead. From nuclear talks in Asia to the Middle East, Defense Secretary Robert Gates is in Israel today, where all the talk is about Iran's nuclear program. Now, Israel's defense minister said that his country won't take any option off the table in dealing with Iran's nuclear program. Speaking together, Gates offered support from the U.S.
We are contributing both financial and technical assistance to strengthen Israel's defense against the growing threat posed by rockets and missiles.
And we'll have more on those talks coming up a little bit later. Now, members of the opposition party are asking for a permit to hold a ceremony for the people killed during the protests of June's presidential election.
In Iran?
Absolutely, in Iran. They're asking to hold the event on the 40th day after demonstrations started. And for many Muslims in Iran, the 40th day is the last formal day of mourning. Let's look at top stories in the news.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here. He's soft-spoken, but he's certainly not low-profile. Here's Defense Secretary Robert Gates, who's in Jerusalem, speaking about the challenges ahead in the Middle East.
While we know that forging a lasting peace will not be quick or easy, we also know that peace is in the interest of all countries in the region, that it is the only way that Israelis and Palestinians alike can enjoy the safety and security they deserve.
That's Robert Gates speaking after a breakfast this morning with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and he's going to have lunch with Defense Minister Ehud Barak. Gates is just one of a steady stream of high-profile U.S. visitors going to Israel or the region this week, including Middle East envoy George Mitchell and National Security Advisor Jim Jones, among others. There is definitely a lot on the table. Here to talk about it is Ethan Bronner, New York Times Jerusalem Bureau Chief, who joins us from Jerusalem. Good morning, Ethan.
Good morning, John.
And from Washington, D.C., Judith Kipper, Director of the Middle East Programs at the Institute of World Affairs, joins us. Good morning, Judith.
Good morning.
Ethan, I'm wondering, there's been a lot of high-profile statements about Iran, and particularly about the Middle East, from the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton. But is there a way of sensing the importance of the Barack Obama Robert Gates relationship insofar as that has clout in Israel about issues like Iran and the Palestinian question broadly?
Well, I mean, I think that I don't know that Hillary Clinton said anything all that different from Gates. The issue of an American defensive shield came up today in the press conference between Gates and Barak. I mean, I don't know enough about the relationship between Gates and Obama to really address that thoughtfully. I would just say that in this country, as in many countries, the foreign ministry or the State Department is always a little bit second fiddle to the defense ministry and to the guys with the guns. And they're certainly very happy to have Gates here. And there was some disagreement about how much the United States, how much time the United States should give to the dialogue with Iran or whether it should occur at all. But they've clearly made their peace with it existing. They just want it to be short.
Is there any sense that Gates and Israeli officials are talking about specific modalities should Iran develop a nuclear weapon and actually deploy it? I mean, it was very unusual, it seemed to me, for Hillary Clinton to talk about this defensive shield when she was in Asia. But I'm wondering if they're trying to nail down what would happen if.
Well, I think it's a great question, but I can't really answer it. I just don't know. I mean, I'm not in the room, and what is being said outside the room afterwards does not include that kind of detail.
Sure.
It seems likely that on some level there's a concern about it, but for the moment, everyone is saying it's going to be a couple of years away before they actually get it, and let's see what the focus seems to be on a quick effort at dialogue and then severe sanctions afterward.
Right. And I make a habit of asking you questions that, it's impossible. No one is in the room for these kinds of questions. But I think, is it fair to say that if the Obama administration can demonstrate progress on the Iran question, that it paves the way for progress on the Palestinian question?
Well, I think, yes, although there's an additional connector in there, which is that to get the Arab governments in the region feeling that they're together on something and not having to worry so much about Iran's nuclear ambitions and therefore can move into this other area. So, yes, I think that's true. But broadly, what seems to be happening with all of these visitors and Gates right this week is a notion of a series of moving parts that the Israelis would agree to some kind of temporary settlement freeze, and at the same time there'd be offers or at least in the pocket suggestions of ways in which these Arab governments could make it worthwhile to Israel.
All right, hold on there, Ethan. I'm going to ask a couple of questions to Judith Kipper, who's Director of Middle East Programs at the Institute of World Affairs. We've just been speaking with Ethan Bronner of the New York Times. Judith, is a strategy emerging here in that possibly Iran's nuclear development is an advantage for the Obama administration in getting credibility with Israel on the Palestinian question?
No, I don't think so. I think that the declared position of the Obama administration that they will not tolerate Iran developing a nuclear weapon is a major international, global, American strategic goal. And I think that it cannot be seen in any other context. Obviously, if the Iranians continue to develop a bomb, a nuclear weapon, the U.S. is going to have some very, very tough questions in the future. Dialogue, sanctions, and if none of that works, then what? The military option is on the table, and clearly that is a nightmare scenario. Iran is a huge country, and the U.S. is overextended militarily in Afghanistan and Iraq. No one wants to see the Israelis go in and do a piece of the job. So this, I think, is not in any way can be looked at as a political advantage.
So it's sobering to think that it's a huge distraction. I guess I'm wondering, is it possible to understand what clout the U.S. has with George Mitchell and Jim Jones, National Security Advisor, in addition to Robert Gates in the region?
I think there's two things going on here from the side of the United States. I think, first of all, the series of visitors to Israel to show that we care, that to reassure that the strategic relationship is as strong as ever, that it is permanent, there is no question about it. But on the other side, to also demonstrate that U.S. and Israeli interests are not always identical, and in the end, the U.S. is the big guy. So I think that it is a dual thing here, to reassure the Israelis, but at the same time to put pressure on them that the Obama administration means what it says and that they really need to start to think about taking some action on settlements, to be tolerant and quiet about the U.S. Dialogue with Iran, because obviously Israeli nipping at our heels every step of the way will in many ways weaken any dialogue the U.S. can set up with Iran.
Judith Kipper, Director of Middle East Programs at the Institute for World Affairs, thanks so much for that analysis. She joined us from Washington, D.C. Ethan Bronner, quickly, what do we look ahead for with the Gates trip to Israel in the next 24 hours?
Well, Gates is already gone. He spoke with both the prime minister and the defense minister today. He's in Jordan, either in Jordan or in the air to Jordan right now. The next big moves here are Mitchell, Dennis Ross, and, as you said, General James Jones. I think those conversations are going to be more focused on the Israeli-Palestinian issue, because several of them are also going to Ramallah to see the Palestinians.
Right.
So the question of Palestinian security forces and Israel's agreement to ease life in the West Bank and to do something about settlements. I think that's going to be the focus, along with the desire to get the Arab countries to do something in exchange.
Terrific. Thanks. Ethan Bronner, New York Times Jerusalem Bureau Chief, speaking with us from Jerusalem. And Femi Okeh has time for quick headlines. Sorry, Femi.
Yeah, Gianna. I kind of missed you last week.
Right.
I didn't have time to do news.
Sarkozy's okay, though, right?
He is. He's out of hospital. Also, of course, a big story we're following this morning. Chinese representatives in Washington today likely to talk about the U.S.'s growing trade deficit with China.
And what's it mean to be furloughed coming up on The Takeaway? Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Within the last 15 minutes, President Obama began speaking to the opening session of 2 days of critical talks with top leaders from Beijing.
I have learned from the words of Yao Ming, who said, no matter whether you are new or an old team member, you need time to adjust to one another.
Speaking about Yao Ming and many other issues, President Obama speaking as the Chinese and U.S. officials get down to business. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton leads the strategic side of these high-level talks, and Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner takes the economic side. And the Chinese, of course, have their own priorities at these talks, so what's on their agenda? Earlier this morning, BBC correspondent Chris Hogg joined us from Shanghai. I asked him what he's expecting on his end.
Well, the reason that the Chinese are so interested in following these talks is twofold, really. I mean, first of all, there is an acceptance that this country and America are bound tightly together. Their two economies need each other. One of my colleagues has put it this way. The American addiction to debt means that China is in the position of being their dealer. And, of course, that means that they're piling more and more of the excess dollars that they've earned here in China into the American system. So the second point is that the Chinese are very worried about the state of the American economy. They're worried about the size of President Obama's stimulus package, because they're worried that that's going to create inflation. And so as a result, the value, the massive of their massive debt, the dollar holdings that they have, the Treasury securities, is going to um, is is going to go down, get smaller.
It's estimated at about $2 trillion now. Are there any headlines in China or sort of commentators calling for the U.S. to be lectured to by the Chinese to say we're going to cut off investment if things don't change?
Certainly in the last 24 hours or so, there have been articles in the major papers about this. They're not really lecturing the United States, but I think they're pretty much following on from the kind of comments we've seen from the People's Bank of China, the central bank here. I mean, certainly the central bank governor has said in recent weeks that he sees the need to keep pumping this money, to have this capital transfer from China to the United States. But that he said it's not good for the economy. And basically what the Americans need to do is they need to sort out their economic fundamentals. They can't rely on China to be doing this forever.
Chris Hogg, is it plausible from the Chinese perspective that there would be some sort of quid pro quo between China having influence in North Korea on the nuclear question versus some of these more delicate economic issues that the U.S. has an interest in?
I think that's a difficult question to answer. I mean, again, North Korea is a situation where America needs China to help them try to sort this out, because there is this feeling in the States that the Chinese have exert the most influence over Pyongyang. Although I have to tell you there are some Chinese scholars who, after the missile tests earlier in the year, said that their concern was that in fact even Chinese influence over North Korea is on the wane. So I mean, frankly, for the Obama administration, probably the Chinese is the best game in town, and that's what they have to go with.
We spoke with BBC correspondent Chris Hogg earlier this morning. The president is speaking at the beginning of these talks in Washington, D.C., and as he's been speaking, the markets on Wall Street have poked into positive territory. Chris Hogg spoke with us from Shanghai. And again, those two-day talks just beginning in Washington today. The Chinese have sent 150 diplomats.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the practice of renting dogs to people who desire canine companionship when visiting a new city. Who does it really comfort and who does it exploit? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. What does it mean to be furloughed by your employer? Thousands and thousands of Americans are being furloughed in this recession. Tell us your story at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and we're going to talk about what furloughs actually mean with financial expert Beth Kobliner when she joins us right after headlines with Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much, John. 12 minutes to the top of the hour, almost. High-level U.S.-China talks are going on right now in Washington. President Obama kicked off the meeting, speaking just a few moments ago.
This is an essential step in advancing a positive, constructive, and comprehensive relationship between our countries.
Now the meeting continues. President Obama is still speaking. Meanwhile, China's vice premier just said that the world economy is moving out of crisis toward recovery. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner are also involved in the two-day talks with the visiting Chinese. Plenty on the table to talk about, including financial, security, and environmental issues. Healthcare, of course, is another big topic in D.C. today. House Democrats meet today for extensive talks. There are still major differences within the Democratic Party on how to overhaul healthcare, not to mention plenty of skepticism on the Republican side. The exiled Honduran president Manuel Zelaya is camping out outside his country's borders in a bid to get back into power. He's also criticizing the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, for calling his trip a reckless. And finally, the United States Navy says that weather is pirate perfect right now. What does that mean? Well, basically the monsoon rains, the hefty rains that go across the central part of the world, they're actually easing off now, and ships need to warn out there could be more attacks off the Somali coastline. John.
Thank you, Femi. So April 1st for most of us is what, Femi? It's April
Fool's Day.
There you go.
Yes.
But to Tim Kirkwood, flight attendant, author of The Flight Attendant Job Finder and Career Guide, it was more of an economic milestone. Tim, what happened to you on April 1st?
That's when I was furloughed from my full-time job.
Furloughed. Would you define the word furlough for me, please?
Well, furlough in a union seniority-based system means that you've been laid off from work. You are, you know, no longer part of the company, but you are on a list for recall. They have to call you back before they can hire anybody off the street.
All right. Jason Ramirez, what does furlough mean to you?
Well, furlough mean for myself is taking a few days off. Actually, a forced taking a couple days off from work. For me, it was 2 days a month and a 10% reduction in my pay.
Two voices there of an economic statistic that's actually predominating in this recession economy. Jason Ramirez works in web design and video production. He's out in Los Angeles, California. Tim Kirkwood, who we just spoke with, flight attendant, been on full-time furlough since April 1st. He joins us from San Francisco. Here in the studio, Beth Koblenner, personal finance expert and author of the New York Times bestseller, Get a Financial Life, right here in the studio. Beth, what does it mean to be furloughed, and how do you go about surviving a furlough versus a layoff?
Right. Well, it's really tough. You know, it's this temporary reduction in time worked, but it's really a euphemism for people not getting paid and being told, don't come into work for those few days. You know, it's interesting. I looked into the history of furloughs, and back in 1932, Herbert Hoover furloughed most federal workers earning over $1,000, and he told them not to come into work for a month. And now we're seeing furloughs happening. You know, we traditionally think of it as manufacturing jobs and the airlines, like our guest here, but we're now seeing it more go into the publishing industry, even the finance industry, where companies are saying, you know what, take off a few days, take off a week. We don't want you to come in, and we're not going to pay you.
And it sounds very benign, as Beth says it. Furlough, hey, furlough, take a month off.
It's very all in this together.
Right, she's an economic analyst, but when you hear furlough, Jason, does that sound benign to you?
Yeah, a little bit, but you know, I'm trying to just make the best with it, and just kind of roll. It kind of helps out versus just losing my job in general.
All right, I want to describe both of your situations here. Jason Ramirez and Tim Kirkwood have important differences. Jason, your furlough is kind of a 2 days a month. It's a reduction in hours, really.
That's correct. Two days a month, and it's a 10% deduction pay, attaining full benefits. So my vacation, 401k.
Right.
And medical benefits all stay the same.
Now, Tim Kirkwood, you're on a union-enforced, basically a layoff, but the seniority says that you get hired back first. That feels a little more draconian than what Jason is going through, right?
Well, yes, because I've just experienced this previously, and that was a 4.5-year furlough.
Whoa.
And we ran close to running off the edge of the cliff there because it was a 5-year recall. At the end of the 5 years, then you're on the street, and if you want to come back, you start all over at the bottom again.
Well, Beth Koblenner, what advice would you have for Jason versus Tim on what you do if you're in this kind of a furlough situation, a kind of hours reduction versus a waiting game, which is what Tim's going through?
Right. Well, what Jason has been doing is, because I talked to him earlier, he actually has been training for other work. He's doing some work for an EMT. He wants to, you know, get into that field. So it's great. One very important thing is to use your time constructively, whether it be putting your resume together or getting some part-time job or even some volunteer work. I think the main thing, though, is even though it has this nice sound, furlough, and it has this kind of all in this together, everybody's sacrificing, everybody's taking off time from work. However, it's a pay cut, and you're getting less money, and you have to adjust your spending. You have to figure out, you know, 2 days a month doesn't sound like a big deal. Oh, 2 days, that sounds pretty good, but it's a 10% pay cut.
That sounds big. Have you adjusted your spending, Jason?
Hey, absolutely. That's definitely happened. Actually, additionally, I've tried to save some money, and I've decided to move home to my parents' home.
There is a big one.
Are your parents there? Put them on the phone. Let's hear them.
Jason Ramirez in Los Angeles, California, works in web design and video production. And a reminder, Tim Kirkwood is a flight attendant in San Francisco, California. I suspect you've adjusted your spending, but I'm curious, Tim, how do you even go about looking for work if you have to say that you could be rehired at any time?
Well, that's the frustrating part, is you have a hard time getting started in that process because you're like, well, I could be back to work next year, or I could be back to work in even 3 or 4 years, and some employers are going, well, we don't want to hire you. And even other airlines have come up with a stipulation of, if you want us to hire you, you have to resign from your recall. so we don't lose you and waste all this training money on you.
And right. that's a terrifying.
It's terrifying. There's also an interesting trend in this for law firms, that law firms have been hiring new people, you know, people graduating from law school, and they say, you know what, we changed our mind. Start in 6 months. Start in a year. So sometimes they're giving people a little bit of money and saying, go do pro bono work and we'll get. But sometimes they're saying, we can't even pay you. So start in 6 months, but don't get a job somewhere else. But, oh, I'm sorry, you're not going to get a paycheck.
And, Beth, you didn't actually want Jason Ramirez to wake up his parents since he's moved home.
Probably not a great idea.
Los Angeles
probably
time.
Not a good
we
idea.
Don't want you to get kicked out of your home there, Jason.
Thank you.
Do you have to say, if you're applying for work, you sound more like a freelancer maybe, but do you have to say to your employer that you have a part-time job right now, and are they compelling you to maybe ditch your burn your bridge if you're going to take full-time work?
No, actually, that's not. I am. I'm not freelancing, but my employer did mention that if we decided we wanted to take part-time jobs, that it was more supportive of it. As for myself, it's worked out well. Where some of my coworkers and colleagues have also pulled their children out of daycare and are spending the day with them in other ways. But my current employer is very supportive of my other career interests as well.
Well, lucky for that. To Jason Ramirez, thanks so much. He works in web design and video production, living at home, among his cost savings since he's been on involuntary furlough since February. And Tim Kirkwood, good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
He's a flight attendant, author of The Flight Attendant Job Finder and Career Guide, and partner in avianation.com. He's been on full-time furlough since April 1st. A sort of a final thought, Beth, on if you're faced with this situation.
Well, I think you have to use it, the silver lining, look at it as an opportunity, figure out what you want to do with those extra days. And one really important one is kind of a side note. If you are now working fewer than 25 to 30 hours, make sure you're still getting health insurance, because that's a cutoff for many employers. So make sure your benefits are still intact.
And there's no loyalty benefit for hanging out on these furlough lists, right? I mean, if you hang out there and just say, okay, I'll take the 10% pay cut, there's no benefit on the upside if the economy turns.
Probably not, although some employers are telling people if they say, okay, we're giving you a furlough, take 6 months off, we're going to give you half your pay, we promise you, you won't be one of the ones laid off.
Will they keep that promise? We'll find out. Beth Koblenner, New York Times bestselling author of Get a Financial Life. We'll check in with you when the economy does turn around, but probably way before then. So have you been furloughed? We want to hear your story. What are you doing with your time off? How are you making ends meet? Do you have advice for other people facing the same situation? You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org, where we're also hearing about how the economy has affected you.
Hi, my name is Kim, and I'm calling from New Jersey. And I'm affected by the economy because my husband is a union worker. He's been laid off since February, and we've been trying to reduce our mortgage with Countrywide. Well, supposedly got a bailout, and they've been fighting with us and not really cooperating.
And if you're following the healthcare debate, here's your takeaway this morning.
If you look at the news coverage as your indicator of what's getting through to the public, what you see is that the Obama administration and the press coverage are both focused now on cost control more so than increasing coverage.
Listen to Kathleen Hall Jamison there, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania, on our podcast to go. Subscribe at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE. Or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With 3 updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.